You're listening to a podcast from the University of Manchester. Welcome to the Research Beacons podcast, a series of illuminating conversations that shine a light on research at Manchester and our innovative solutions to global challenges. Our Research Beacons podcast series highlights how researchers at the University of Manchester are finding solutions to global challenges across five key areas: advanced materials, cancer, energy, global inequalities, and industrial biotechnology, our key research beacons.
In part three of our Spotlight on Energy podcast on Keeping the Lights On, I'm joined by Dr. John Broderick. Today, we're going to be talking about the term keeping the lights on and what that means for us as citizens and what we can do to really help with striving for this zero carbon targets that we're trying to achieve to mitigate the effects of climate change. So we'll cover a few issues around that. But firstly, John, over to you. If you'd like to tell us who you are and what you do.
So my name's John Broderick and I'm a lecturer in the Department of Mechanical Aerospace Civil Engineering. And I do research as part of the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research.
Fantastic. Could you tell us a little bit more about the Tyndall Centre and maybe anything that's kind of special about that that group or facility?
So I really enjoy working at the Tyndall Centre because it is such a diverse community of researchers. We have got engineers and physical scientists, natural scientists and social scientists as well. So we have people who work on sociology and social psychology alongside people working on the fundamental technologies.
So that's kind of multidisciplinary research coming together for the greater good to find solutions.
And to analyse the problems that climate change puts up towards us. Particularly in Manchester, we focus on the energy system.
And kind of your area of research, you can tell us a bit more about that and what got you interested in that.
So I'm interested in carbon budgeting. So I look at the quantities of emissions on aggregate that energy systems and energy technologies produce. So I got into this about 10 years ago when aviation and offsetting was becoming a hot topic. And we were looking at what we could do to reduce the impact of air travel. Now that went quiet for a bit and I did some work on shale gas and on smart grids. But aviation is coming back around. And so that's where some current research direction is going.
And what motivated you to get into this? Was it something you saw on the news, something that had an impact on you personally?
So the start of this motivation is as a sixth former, I won a science prize. And the prize was to go on an ecology field trip in the Bahamas, which was all very exciting and glamorous. But when we got out there, the coral reefs that we were meant to be monitoring were in a pretty bad state. They were suffering from coral bleaching. And I don't know if you know, but the corals themselves are a symbiosis between a little sea anemone creature that builds the physical skeleton, the carbonate skeleton of the coral reef, and has little tentacles and captures plankton. But also within its cells, it has some algae that photosynthesize. And when the corals are stressed, they eject those algae. The symbiosis breaks down. They go white. They lose their colour because they lose their photosynthetic pigments. And then they, can ultimately and frequently do die off. And that removes the physical basis of the whole coral reef ecosystem. So this was many moons ago, and we were seeing that in that particular year, a significant bleaching event, and it was striking. I mean, visually striking, seeing white corals on the reef. So that really made me think about the physical and the biological consequences of climate change.
Yeah, that's a really tangible experience, I guess, that kind of roots what's happening, what we've contributed to. You can actually see the effects of that in
person.
And I guess we're seeing more and more of these kind of
effects. And coral ecosystems are some of the first that will be most heavily affected by climate change, because it's the warming background temperatures that drive this stress that causes the bleaching impact.
And there's examples, obviously, we can sort of see ice caps melting all the way through to the fires in Australia, and it's kind of, it looks like we're getting more and more signals that the planet's not going to cope very well forever with the contribution we're making to carbon emissions.
Yes, and so I decided a few years later that actually I didn't just want to be watching things going downhill. I wanted to be working, analysing the causes of the problems and the solutions to the problems. So that's how I end up in an engineering department.
Well, thank you for all the work you are doing to benefit the world. And we'll probably come on to a little bit more about what you do there. Just to link into the theme of the podcast and the previous conversations we've had on parts one and two, we're talking about keeping the lights on as a theme for our spotlight on energy. And we've covered generation and how we can meet the demand through generation. And obviously climate change came up quite heavily in that conversation, looking at how we can find energy sources that are low carbon emitters or zero carbon emitters. We talked to experts in the field of nuclear energy as a clean fuel and how we can kind of bridge the energy gap with nuclear power and plant life extension of existing reactors to keep the power going. We also talked to Dr. Andrew Welfel, who told us about his work in bioenergy as a clean source of renewable energy to help move away from our dependence on fossil fuels. So we covered those kind of generation issues in part one. And then in part two, we talked about the resilience of the network and the work that some of our academics in the departments of electrical electronic engineering are doing about the grid and how we can make the grid more resilient and robust, obviously with the integration of more renewables on the system, the fact that it's quite an old network, 60 years old, and also kind of extreme weather events and kind of looking globally as well at places like Chile and how the electricity network stands up to some black swan extreme weather events. So we've covered those kind of areas in terms of how we can keep the lights on, both from meeting that energy demand, but looking at low carbon energy sources. And we've also spoken about the network itself and how that can bear up. We're sat here with the lights on. We just take that for granted that that will always be the case, that we'll have access to electricity. So I just wondered kind of what your thoughts are around keeping the lights on.
Keeping the lights on. It's a phrase that turns up a lot, but actually I don't think is terribly helpful when we're thinking about the energy system. Mm-hmm. From two main perspectives. So the first is quite a trivial one. It's about lights, and we use that as a metaphor that stands in for energy, but it tends to stand in for electricity. And we need to remember that electricity is only a small part of our energy system. It's only about a seventh of the total primary energy that we consume that is coming to us as a form of electricity. And so we need to look much broader at how we produce and consume energy. And we need to recognise how much energy is used in heat and in transport that currently has very little to do with the electricity system. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that it sets up the idea that somebody else should be responsible for keeping the lights on and that we are passive beneficiaries of their work. Actually, I think as we move towards greater penetration of intermittent renewables and potentially inflexible nuclear plants or plants with limited flexibility, and we move more demands onto our electricity system, so we move that heat and road transport towards electrification, then we're going to have to become more active and involved ourselves as participants in the energy system and become familiar with using energy in a different way. So I'll give you a trivial example. My wife and I have an electric vehicle at home, and we also have an Economy 7 tariff, which enables us to charge it at a very low rate through the middle of the night on an off-peak basis. Now, this has benefits both for the network and for us financially, where we see a much lower cost on our electricity bills. But it still requires us to manually set the timer on the vehicle, plug the car in at particular times, maybe go back out in the cold after dark to make sure it's set. And actually, that's a bit of a burden, to be honest, but maybe one that we need to shoulder ourselves. I mean, actually, it's, when we think about the service that vehicle provides, going back out at night and plugging the car in is a pretty kind of small additional effort, and also something that maybe technology providers need to be working with the integration of those systems so we can automate some of this so that we don't have to have so much manual intervention. So with keeping the lights on hides a couple of the really key themes that I think will be part of our energy system transformation in the next decade or two.
Mm. So, I mean, there's a lot of talk around things like smart grid interventions and that being kind of quite key for going forwards. And obviously you touch as well on consumer behaviour as well and changes and shifts in how we live our lives day to day and how we ourselves can contribute to the big issues on energy. I guess it'd be really good at this point to ask you if there's anybody kind of listening out there and thinking, what can I do? What are the kind of maybe top tips that people could do on a practical level that will make a real impact on mitigating against climate change and our emissions and helping conserve energy as well, I guess?
Well, so given that we're talking in the UK in 2020, I think one of the biggest things people can do is speak to their elected representatives, speak to their local and their national politicians about the climate negotiations that are going to happen in Glasgow. I think the UK taking a strong leadership position there and being effective is the most significant thing that we can do globally as citizens. So the first thing I would say to people to do is, if they think that climate change and energy system transformation is important, is to make sure that their politicians know that that's the case. In terms of what we can do in our own lives, reducing the quantity of energy that we demand makes it so much easier for the rest of the energy system to be able to meet those demands. So looking at how much we travel, how energy intensive that travel is, looking at how we use heat in our homes, they would be the next things to do. Now, they're not easy things, they're not little things, but they're things that will make a big difference. So I would encourage people to think about their home insulation and what they could do to reduce the amount of heat. Think about the controls in their heating systems. Do they need to be heating all of the house all of the time? Or can they get a little bit smarter with some thermostatic radiator valves and maybe some smart controls or just a well-set timer control? And then think about road transport and air transport, particularly because they're the most carbon intensive at present, how far and how frequently we're travelling, and are there opportunities to reduce that?
Fantastic. I shall stock up on my supply of jumpers and thermals to wear around the house.
Again, just as a little kind of personal anecdote with that, 2 or 3 years ago, we did a big insulation project on our home, and I have been absolutely overjoyed at how the house feels now, because all of the walls are at a moderate, comfortable temperature for much longer part of the day. The house is just so much nicer to be in. It was a lot of upheaval to do the works, but I've been so pleased with it.
It all pays off, doesn't it? And like you say, people might think these actions, you know, I'm quite insignificant, what change can I make? But I guess at scale, little actions actually do contribute a hell of a lot.
Well, they do when they multiply, when you talk to other people. So when you talk to the building industry, when you say, I want higher standards, when you encourage people to do things slightly differently, when you show and you tell other people about it, that's when you begin to see a broader social change. So I think it's not just enough to be to passively consume some of these technologies, but to actively increase their uptake more broadly.
Yeah, it's great to have all this on the radar, isn't it? And we're talking about keeping the lights on. We need to make sure we're turning them off in rooms where we're not going to be using those rooms as we exit from one room to another, and that kind of thing as well. So you mentioned COP26. If you could talk to one of the cabinet ministers, have you got any kind of top things you would be saying to them?
I mean, I think that they should recognise the scale of the issue. Because we have been talking and making such limited progress to date, we are making the problem harder and harder for ourselves. So I would encourage all global leaders to recognise the scale of that challenge and to stop obfuscating and to be able to bring forth some strong collaborations and commitments. I think we need some progress on particularly the aviation sector, because there hasn't been to date. ICAO has been moving slowly and has only proposed an offsetting scheme rather than reductions within the sector. And so I think that that is something that needs to be addressed. But that's not going to be the major topic of conversation at COP26. At COP26, we need ambition on the emissions targets that matches the ambition in the temperature targets that are in the Paris Agreement from 2015.
So it's joining all that together and working together across countries and different politicians committing to all that change.
I think we're going to need to for someone to show some leadership and then bring other people with them, however that's achieved at international diplomatic levels. And so that's really what I think the UK could offer.
And I think a really good example of what the UK is doing, and Tyndall Manchester were involved in this, obviously, it's great to talk about, is the city carbon budgets and the work that was done there by Tyndall Manchester. And that's obviously contributing towards GMCA's carbon targets for 2038.
Yeah, so what we did there was strip out the negative emissions technologies from many of the future emissions reduction scenarios. So there's the presumption in lots of government and scientific models that we have technology that takes CO2 out of the atmosphere in the second half of the century. Now, that's a big ask to be able to deliver those technologies at the global scale. It's not to say that the technologies are a pipe dream. We have them as demonstrators. We know they exist. But to scale them up is a big risk. So we took that out and we said, what are the safe quantities of emissions that could be fairly allocated to a developed country like the UK? And then how could that be scaled down to the city? And what we found is that we need to have very significant increases in the rates of reductions that we're seeing at the moment. So the recent trend has been reductions of the order of about 6% per annum, slowing last year. And that's been due to us getting coal out of the national electricity system. That's a really kind of significant piece of progress, but it's a one-off and we need to keep pushing. And in fact, we found that we needed to increase that rate of reduction to greater than 10% per annum. So it's not just the 2038 zero target that we have. That's important. We need to know that everything needs to get to zero. That's just a kind of a fundamental feature of the climate science and the way that CO2 accumulates in the atmosphere. If we don't have emission sucking technologies, then you have to get to zero. And then the other part is that, yes, we need to be keeping ourselves within a carbon budget. And the carbon budget shows us that we need to be looking at greater than 10% per annum reductions and really scaling up our efforts. And that perhaps implies, coming back to the issues that I mentioned in the introduction, is that we think more about how we demand energy and how we demand particularly carbon-intensive energy services. Because the quickest and the easiest way of cutting our emissions is to cut our demand for services like air travel that currently have a very high carbon intensity.
Great. Thanks, John. That's been fantastic. So the key takeout I've taken from all this is we need to act now, and that action needs to be both on the micro and the macro level, all the way from the actions we take as individuals through to our kind of in a regional level like GMCA are doing, all the way up to a global and what we're doing together as one planet to save the world. Thank you for your time.
To hear more about our research in advanced materials, cancer, energy, global inequalities and industrial biotechnology, go to manchester.ac.uk